In the end, Kerry sounded just like Bush. They were both in favor of the war. Now, the one thing that the senator, the governor of Vermont, proved was that there was a huge anti-war party. The Americans have always, we as a people, believed in minding our own business, not in attacking other countries. We had enough to do at home and so on. This has all been imported. And this all comes out of corporate America, out of a ghastly educational system. And we now have a government which is not only not representative of the American people, even as republics go, but nowhere near a democracy. But democracy is a nice word. It's like ketchup. You can put it on everything. We are bringing democracy to Iraq, and we'll bring it to Iran. And one day it may actually come to the United States, but I don't think any of us will live that long.
Your knowledge, your education, and social exposure has given you a familiarity with American history that is rarely paralleled. And I'm wondering if you can look back over your knowledge of prior presidents and administrations and put George W. Bush in context and compare him to where we are today and where other presidential leaders have been.
I don't see that you can compare him. He doesn't come out of any political system that we've ever tried before. He wasn't elected the first time around in the year 2000. That was a faked election, and he was brought in by corrupt practices. He may have been the second time, or he may not have, but whatever it was, the presidential election was not fought on any issues. The war, the morality of the war, and the wisdom of the war, and the wisdom of our techniques used against foreigners, like torture and concentration camps, none of this was part of the public debate. We were talking about abortion, homosexual marriages. Aren't these great topics? These are really great topics for a great people on the march with atomic weapons to be discussing. There was so much really to talk about, and neither Kerry nor Bush was about to do it, and they both approved of the war because their advisors, certainly Kerry's advisors, had told him that. The result is, we are going on, I had a title of a little book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. I didn't know how prophetic that title was. This is perpetual war. And after Iran, we'll make Russia angry at us, or somebody else out there. God help us if we make China angry at us. There are much more of them than there are of us. This war will end in our defeat, and that is why I want us to get out of it. I want us to bring the troops home, and I want us to try and invent an educational system so that really maniacs don't get in charge of the levers of power.
Bringing this back home to domestic policy, Gore Vidal, we have an election in which the president ran on the fears of conservative pockets of voters, on a platform of homophobia, even though he does claim to have a mandate. To round out our assessment, can you look at what you think the administration means in terms of domestic policy?
It's the last gold rush. It was 1849, I think. I'm out here in California as I speak to you. That California filled up with people because they discovered gold, and the gold rush was on. Well, the gold rush is now on. Now, the last pile of gold in the United States is the money that we have given, since the age of 16, which is quite a long time ago. It's when I first worked and paid Social Security. The gold rush is for the bankers and the brokers and the people with mutual funds can get their hands on Social Security money. So you begin with a series of lies, the way they began the Iraq war. Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons. He's going to use them immediately. We've got to act fast. Stop him. So people fell for that. Now we hear 2018, Social Security, there won't be any money left. We've got to start to fix it now. We'll privatize it. What does that mean? We'll hand all the money in Social Security over to Wall Street. They'll invest it for you, and every man a king. You will end up a rich capitalist, which is the dream of every good American. Well, you're going to end up a very poor capitalist because they're going to take that money. They will lose it as they always do. I've never known any boom, certainly a bubble as big as this one would be, that doesn't break. It is totally impractical. It cannot work. All we have to do is look across the water at Great Britain. Thanks to Mrs. Thatcher, they tried something like that too. privatizing a certain amount of retirement money for people of modest means as they got older. They found out they've lost all the money. Well, the money just didn't hold up. It couldn't bear up with the changes in the marketplace. That's very well known. Not that our media would tell us, because our media is totally corrupt. It's owned by the same people who are in the gold rush. So they're going to keep telling us, oh, Social Security is finished. It's just absolutely finished. We've got to go privatize it. And they'll talk about the great success in England, where it's a disaster. And the British are talking about our Social Security system as it now works as being the ideal.
The sound of Gore Vidal speaking with us on the occasion of the second inauguration of George W. Bush. And that concludes tonight's edition of Earthwatch. That excerpt from today's edition, Memorial Edition, for Gore Vidal. And thank you for tuning in, and thank you for Rick Iredem of MarsNow.info. See you next week, and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jem Freund, coming up right after this on WBAI Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York.
Oh, that's me? Okay. You didn't have any outro music. Well, let me...
Well, actually, I do.
You do? Well, I just started my intro, Robert.
Oh, okay.
But let's... let's all howl like the birdies howl. Jeez. Yeah, sit there, Daniel. R.I.P. Gore Vidal. That was... what was he? 86? 86, yeah. And it was interesting. How many people... I started the intro. The computer hasn't seen fit to play it, though. I don't know why. There it is. Oh, on the same player you were using. God. Oh, I know why.
Oh, gee.
Totally my fault.
It would be great. Let's just turn this into an internet radio station, because the internet and computers work real good.
No, this was my FU. This was like not bringing up the pot.
Who needs broadcast?
I do. Anyway, Earthwatch was brought to you live, with portions on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jem Freund. This is a program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. We broadcast here between fund drives. Tonight, with us, Daniel Jose Older. You may not have heard of him. You will. Stay tuned. Yeah, the usual smooth transition. That means that you know you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Thank you, yes. And, there it is. I was going to say, where the did I leave my coffee? And I've got it. So excuse me one second, folks, because I'll show you how prepared I was before going on the air. Daniel was asking me, are you ever at a loss for words on the air? And sadly, no. But good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf here after a month's absence, where we are here for 6 weeks. And that was after a 6 week absence. But what can I say? Things will change. I mean, that could mean that we go off the air. We have a new program director who's an interesting fellow by the name of Chris Hotzis. And, you know, change had started happening under Tony Bates. I think change will continue happening, and we can all hope for it to be good. And one of those things is that we must learn how to fundraise off the air and how to make the fundraising more efficient and various things like that. And we are all here painfully aware of it, as I'm sure so are those of you who are left listening after another fund drive. But apparently there are enough of you. And thank you, by the way, everybody who pledged when I was here 2 weeks ago on in this time slot for the in Robert's time slot. In Robert's time slot for the Bradbury special. So thank you, Robert's listeners, and Robert. Although I still think you ought to have been there in a certain way, because you know your Bradbury.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you know our Bradbury, in fact.
That'd be nothing without the vision.
Yeah. That's actually a very good way of putting it. But let's see. Announcements to be made. I don't really have any. I'm not aware of any. Well, there's usually a reading.
So that was your announcement.
That was my announcement. There's a new reading series in town called the Kindred Reading Series, but they've only had the one. And as soon as I get emails from Jen Brissett, I will tell you more. The first one was spectacular. I filmed it, and it was Jen Brissett and Kiini, I'm forgetting, Iburu Salam.
That's correct.
Kiini Iburu Salam, who's been on this program, although not in like 8 years. She really is. She's really tremendously good. And she's going to be on this program within the month.
Excellent.
I've got plans for all kinds of people.
Jen Brissett is incredible, so the two of them.
Oh, yeah,
I wish I could have been there for that reading. I wasn't able to make it.
Yeah, that was the first time I tried out my camera. The second time I tried out my new camera. I used to have a little flip,
I thought it was ReaderCon the first time you tried that.
No.
Okay.
No, it was actually, that was the first time I tried it on the fly. No, the first, and also with a mic.
Okay.
That was actually the point.
I've heard several stories of the first time you tried that camera.
That was the first time I tried it with my recorder.
I see.
And I got a new recorder, I won't mention brand names here.
Gotcha.
I love my Flip, but you can't even buy them anymore. Wow. And if you do, they're like, they're a dying breed.
Right.
So you might be able to find one, but Cisco basically killed the company. They didn't sell the company.
Right.
They sold. They folded a profitable company, putting 600 people out of work. Way to go, Cisco. Anyway.
The Kindred Reading Series. I'm actually doing one with N.K. Jemisin on November 28th at McNally and Rand Bookstore.
Oh, really?
Yes.
McNally Jackson?
Jackson, thank you.
Okay, I am very pleased and surprised that they took Kindred in there. Okay. Yeah, because they sort of ousted a previous science fiction reading series that was there, and I won't get into that on
okay.
the air.
Well, there's more dates for the Kindred reading series. I don't have them in front of me, but
yeah,
it's a great series.
Yeah, but it has extreme promise, and it is my intent to film and record and broadcast those. Excellent. And yeah, Nora is supposed to be on this show again sometime soon, but her problem is, and this is really like unforgivable, she works for a living.
So do I.
Yeah, so do you. But you have flexible hours.
I do.
And she does not. Indeed. You, we need to tell the listeners, are Daniel Jose Older.
That's me.
And all of those are basically as written, older, as in younger, older, Jose.
With the accent on the E.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Which is not that easy to do in emails. I have to cut and paste it from some other place. How do you do the E?
I use a Mac, so it's pretty easy, actually.
Yeah, but you see, there's the problem. There's the problem. When you send an email from yes. the Mac to anybody else, they see
it
garbage.
It comes in the thing. That's true.
It comes in as garbage.
We don't have to have that debate right now.
It's not a debate. It's simply, there's a thing called ASCII, which has been used since the 40s.
Yes.
And one company in the world doesn't use it.
Hmm.
And the AS and ASCII stands for, well, it's the AS, American Standard Characters, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And it's really an annoyance. They need to rewrite ASCII. They need to recodify it because there are too many people that have accents in their names, whether they are Germanic people with umlauts, or whatever. Some people go so far as to change the spelling of their name.
Very sad.
It really is. It's improper. It is stealing culture.
Indeed.
Or giving the giving up of culture.
I love my accent. I will never change it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But having said that, that means that only people with the same brand
right.
see it without translation software. The mail that I use does translate it, but not if I read it in my webmail.
Ah.
My webmail will not translate. It comes in as garbage. And as a result, because it's got garbage in the name, it gets discarded as spam.
Mm. It actually took some work to get Amazon to put that accent in because they had a whole system of other things.
They're another. They
are another.
They are yes, they're they are. Another. There are no good guys in this ongoing battle and fight. There are no good guys. Anyway, all this is far afoot from the fact that another phrase that you have to learn outside of Daniel Jose Older is salsa nocturna, which is what is it exactly? I haven't bothered to figure it. It's not hot night.
I call it ghost noir.
Yeah, well, that's a description.
Yes.
Of your stories overall.
Yes.
And it's a perfect description, but with the understanding that so much noir, like so much fiction and movies today,
mm-hmm.
are so, I was going to say spiritless, no, are so serious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So down in the, you know, head between the legs, depressing. And your stuff isn't. It just isn't. Your stuff is, even when it's very serious, even when bad stuff is going on.
And it does.
And it, oh God, does it ever. It's out loud laughing. It's laughing at the pain, laughing at the joy. There are good outcomes to bad situations, even when the outcome itself, such as somebody dying.
No spoilers, but yes.
can be an uplifting ending.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's correct. That's exactly it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So that even when that happens, you leave the story feeling good.
Let me rephrase
all that. I feel the story. When I say you, yeah. I'm impressing my thoughts on everybody else. But in fact, this is how I felt. And I attended the launch of this book, Salsa Nocturna, at the New Yorican Cafe, which has a long history with WBAI, although not a current one. I don't know why, but we used to do a special event. I think I know why, actually. I think the two producers who were largely involved in making that happen are both dead.
Mm.
They're both available in Daniel's books. there was John Fiske, who was a great poetry collector working with the sound of poetry and the sound jet, which is something that you do.
Mm-hmm.
The creating that sound of poetry and prose, and the David Nolan, who was an engineer, who went there to do the remote. But we would broadcast live from the Eureka Cafe at least once a week for 20 years.
Mm. Wow!
Yeah, it was quite a great.
That's a wonderful thing.
That should
happen again. I think.
I think it should.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should. Anybody who thinks that it should write our program director, pd@wbai.org, and also write the Eureka Cafe, because they probably, you know, that's probably a new generation there.
There seems to be, because the sound guy was like 13.
Yeah. Yeah, all the people I met there.
Yeah.
But they were also all cool.
They were amazing. I had such a good time there. I mean, the event was fun, and they were just so welcoming. The setup, and it fit perfectly with the book.
It really did. And I have read Daniel's stories before, and I've heard Daniel read at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, yes, of course. And at some other... No, actually, I've only heard you read at NIRSIF, right?
Yeah, it was the two different ones, that's why.
Yeah, you did one with Terrence Taylor,
right?
No. Terrence Who were your two co-readers?
Amma Patterson.
Amma.
Who I love.
Everybody listening, watch my hand is to my heart when I say the name Amma Patterson. Amma, you must come here and do another radio show, and you must do another NIRSIF reading. Amma is wonderful.
She is
wonderful. God, I love Amma.
Yes.
Is she amazing?
She's amazing. What?
Is she,
I was honored to be with her.
I don't think Jen has her on the schedule yet. Jen is only starting. She's had all of one reading.
Bless Jen's heart. She is putting so much work into the Kindred reading series. But yeah, she's going to get Amma.
She also had, like, the, you know, Brooklyn's coolest bookstore for a while.
I know.
And I went to for Octavia Butler when I was following Octavia around doing her readings.
Wow.
So I went there then. I just thought, this is the coolest store.
I meant to go back
and I never got there. And then the sucker closed.
Yes.
Jen is very much back. Both as a curator of a reading series and...
As a writer.
Yeah. She just sold a story to... Was it Strange Horizon?
I believe, although I'm not sure.
Where you've also sold.
I have.
You have sold to Strange Horizon.
The title story from the book, actually, was published in Strange Horizon.
That's right.
Yeah.
So as I said, I have heard you read. I have read your reading at inappropriate times. Inappropriate meaning...
Define that.
Meaning first drafts that were not intended for anybody but members of your writer's group to see.
Ah, I see.
I have no idea how that happened.
I cannot imagine.
Good to know.
My
partner is in his writer's group. The Tabula Rasa.
Tabula Rasa.
Tabula Rasa writers group.
Yes. Wonderful group of people.
It really is. I mean, we've got about three or four groups in New York. There's Circle in the Hair with Linda Addison and crew. And then there's Altered Fluid, who, by the way, Altered Fluid, message going out, Altered Fluid, time for a show, Altered Fluid.
Oh, that's cool.
The last one was last October. We're supposed to be doing these biannually. I have spoken to members of Alter Fluid individually. This is collectively using the radio, calling all Fluidians. It's time for a show.
You put up the bat signal, so
people.
To speak.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. The AF signal. They used to come live when it was on at 5 a.m.
Cool.
But the irony is that now I'm on at 1:30. They can't do it.
I know. We need to get.
It's because I used to be on Saturday morning.
I know.
And they could sleep after the show.
Right.
But now, you know, so we meet in somebody's office.
Oh, so you're in that group?
No, I'm not. Okay. No, no, no. I record a session about twice a year.
Oh, that's cool.
Where one person reads a news story and right. everybody in the group then does their crit. They do their critique of the story
for
into the microphone.
Wow.
Right? That's and we broadcast a reading of the story with the crits, and then right. we take listener phone calls critiquing the story. Is that like taking your heart out of your, you know, out of
wow.
your body and holding it out for everybody to pet or bleed?
I have a thick skin, and I don't know if I would be down for that.
It's really serious. Yeah, can you imagine?
I think it's great,
really
though.
Tough. We've done nine shows
thing.
Now.
That's a really great thing for writers to hear and be able to tune into and listen to what's
and for listeners to hear, to understand wannabe
yeah.
writers, people who
exactly.
you have the bug.
Absolutely.
And I like to do shows not just for listeners who like to read mm-hmm. and be read to, mm-hmm. but I like to do shows for people who want to write. So this is one of my how-to series.
Yes.
And I've done a number. I've done shows on how to get an agent. I've had panels of agents. I do those. But the Altered Fluid shows are special. They are
that
really cool. I mean, you're left with terrible writers like Nora Jemison and Matthew Kressel and Tempest Bradford and Aliyah Dawn Johnson and David Mercurio Rivera and Paul Berger and E.C. Myers, whose new novel Quantum Coin is just coming out from Pyre, and he'll be on the air to talk about it. And, you know, all these, you know, like... It's like, you know, it must be scary as hell, but I'm pleased to be the platform.
Yes, I'm sure you are.
It's really a great experiment in radio, and I think it has really worked.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's a very cool idea. I didn't know you did that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we'll compile them all for the podcast once I get the bleeping podcast.
So you're saying you've been reading my stuff on the sly?
I've read a couple of things okay. on the sly. The point of it being, I never... saw you perform it before, and I never listened to your music before, and I knew that I was going to the launch party
yeah.
for Salsa Nocturna
right.
at salsanocturna.com, and I did not suggestive thought there. Subliminal, that's it. It was a subliminal,
indeed.
Like tossing the website.
Yes.
The nobody can remember the name of your blog.
Ghoststar.net.
It's okay, I take it back. It can be remembered.
It was new now. Yeah,
it is
good. Ghoststar.net.
Yeah, before that it was like,
it was complicated. Yeah,
it really was.
We've changed it all over. It's consolidated all the ambulance stories, all the writer stuff, thoughts and everything, all the information about updates and new shows coming up. It's all on ghoststar.net.
So I did not know that I was going to love it.
Oh. Well,
I really didn't know that. I'm being straight with you.
I appreciate that.
And let me say, oh, God, was it wonderful. The music was wonderful. The spirit in the audience at the New Yorican was wonderful.
It was a great audience.
It was a great evening. Mm. It really was.
Thank you.
I had a great time. I am so pleased that it went so well.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and but here's the problem now, and
what
this
is
something you and I are going to talk about off mic.
Okay.
Later.
Well.
And we've already started talking about it, is I find it hard to imagine your stories now without the music.
Ah. Well, that's a good thing, I think.
Oh, I think it's a very good thing.
Yeah, indeed.
And by the way, did I show you the studios over there? Anyway.
You know, I almost got the band in for tonight, but it didn't work out.
Damn.
I know. Can you say that on the air? Yes, you can. There's a list.
A list. It's a meaningless list.
It's seven words that we must not use.
And it's not true.
I know,
let's
but my
not
eyes
go into
just,
it now.
Okay.
If right. anybody wants to take me up on it.
Fascinating.
If anybody wants to take me up on it, let me explain. The seven words are Carlin's words.
Can I tweet? I'm going to take a picture of it.
The FCC does not have a list of seven words. The FCC defined, or rather didn't define, simply uses the term indecency. They don't allow indecency. However, how do you define indecency? It's never been defined. However, the rule that invokes indecency was thrown out by the Supreme Court a little under a year ago. So there is no rule forbidding it. We are, however, on our own recognizance, and it is currently Pacifica, which, because we, you know, the Carlin case, we ended up with a bill of over $2 million.
Goodness gracious.
Oh, yeah. 1977 on the Carlin case. We also came up with a concept called safe harbor, which is now used nationally. And safe harbor means that between 10 a.m. and 6 a.m., such things are allowed when they're not obscene.
So I should just read down that list, is what you're saying?
Well, to be used in the context of, say, a Daniel Jose Older story. You know, there's street language in a story if somebody right. has an epithet, whatever. You can't just go on the air and say, I don't want any of this bleeping business. That's not good. But you can read a short story that says, Daniel said, I don't want any of this bleeping business. And all of a sudden, it's all right because it's the context of the story, the context of the fiction. And if you were to take it out of the fiction, you would be lessening the story at a because it's a question of when are children listening. We have the right to free speech, but we do not have the right when children who cannot understand the difference between a disclaimer program and a non-disclaimer program. So at times when children should not be listening without supervision, it is legal, according to the Supreme Court. There was a test of this. It was on a radio show in which a gentleman by the name of Harlan Ellison was broadcast reading a story on a show called Hour of the Wolf, and it made national news, thank you. So I'm familiar.
You're sort of a celebrity.
Not really.
In the curse
world. No. Well, no. That would be Harlan.
Ah, yes.
Who is a master of the curse word, and he doesn't just use it for street talk.
It's an art form, I think.
It really is, and he really masters it. He really gets it right.
Yeah, it's hard work.
But so do you, but for a different reason.
Thank you. I try.
Well, yours is simply the language of New York. And your stories are as New York as I don't know, who are other great New York writers?
I don't know, but it's ironic because I'm from Boston originally.
Yeah, I saw that, but that's also an urban environment.
It is, and I grew up in the heart of Boston. And
what part of Boston?
Charlestown.
Okay, I actually know.
Yes.
Something about where that is,
yes,
yeah.
The Irish heart of Boston.
Oh, God. Yes. So have you discussed this with Mr. Bowes, with Richard Bowes?
We have, at length.
We traded
stories of running away from terrible situations. Because, we were...
Yeah, but at least Rick had the ability to hide as an Irishman.
Right.
Get away with that quite as
not
easily.
At all. They didn't know what to make of us. They were like, you're not Irish. You're not even really white. What are you? So, you know, and Cuban Jew was not really part of the menu of explanations. So we ran.
Are you a Cuban Jew?
I'm a Cuban Jew.
I had no idea.
That's correct.
So you're not even, so for that matter, you're not even the only Cuban in your writer's group.
Right. That's correct. But we were the only Cuban
in Charlestown. Because there's a Cuban from my neighborhood.
Yes.
Quite a time. I'm from Jackson Heights.
Oh, okay.
I only moved to Brooklyn 18 years ago. My first 40 years were in Jackson Heights, Queens, where Carlos Hernandez, who I met on this show.
Another wonderful writer.
When Delia Sherman brought him in for the first Interfictions book.
Ah, cool.
So that's how I met him. He's.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's overdue. He's overdue.
Yes.
So anyway, speaking of overdue, it's already 2:00. Do you want to take a break and read a story? Do you want to just read a story?
I can just read a story. I have a shorter one and then a medium length one.
Because I know that you were advertising on your Twitter feed two stories.
I was.
That the Twitter feed being DJ Older, by the way.
That's my name.
And it's not because you're a DJ.
Or older, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, that's what threw me. It was the DJ.
Did you think I was going to come with turntables?
I did not know. I knew that you did music.
I
didn't know that you did music. Now, that's unfair of me.
Okay.
And it's, but I appreciate all forms of poetry. I'm going to make a statement that will get me hate mail now.
Okay. Keep me out.
But I consider what is referred to as hip hop as poetry, as the sound jet of poetry. I consider it a form of poetry with music, as opposed to music that uses poetry.
We're not about to have that debate. But it's an interesting thought.
And I know, and I'll start with this, and I know I'm wrong.
I don't even
it's just how it lands on my ear.
Okay.
And that's all that it is. I know I'm wrong.
I wouldn't say you're wrong.
And I'm not qualifying anything.
Okay.
I'm qualifying nothing whatsoever.
Fair enough.
But I do know that I can't whistle it when I'm done. But then again, I can't whistle for beans anyway.
So that doesn't mean much.
Yeah, exactly.
So
said that.
Yes, sir. Yes.
So, but I saw the DJ older.
And I confused.
And it's like, okay, but has anybody thought maybe that those are his initials?
Right. I was self-explanatory, but apparently not. Sorry.
But it's fine. And yes. And the other, but it gets all confusing because I've seen your name also just missing the older.
Right, on Facebook.
I wasn't going to say.
That's all right, I don't care. But yes, I'm a man of many names, apparently. Well, you know how social media is these days. Yeah, everyone's got three different...
Yeah, I know. I'm very, very weird. I actually use my name. I don't use handles. I only use handles for people who I think are going to spam me from advertisements and warranties.
Well, that makes sense.
Then I use handles. Otherwise,
right.
C'est moi. But I'm sorry. I'm just yabbering away because I've been... Well, even when I'm on the air regularly, I
quite out of character for you, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. Hitting the mic and all that.
So, shall I read? I mean, I'm good. I don't need.
Yeah, is there any preamble that people need to know?
Not at all.
Okay, good. Then, yeah, just read. And, so you understand about the stupid and decent. When I said those words don't count, it's not that they don't count. It's that it's not about the words.
Understood. I went through in PG-13 for the most part.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for that.
That's quite all right.
Okay.
Hopefully I caught them all. No, I did. This story is, so there's the book is made up of different stories. It's a collection of short stories, and they're told from different points of view for the most part. There's recurring characters, and this is one of them, named Gordo. The story is called Graveyard Waltz. Janie found me at my spot on the graveyard hill late one Sunday afternoon. It's true, I owed my future daughter-in-law for getting me that nice job at the overnight care center for troubled kids, and I owed her even more since I got my ass fired for holding midnight salsa classes, but that's another story. As she got closer, I turned down the music and retrieved a malagueña from my pocket. When I got the graveyard gig, my boy Ernesto bought me an iThing, a slick little music player, and loaded it up with all of my favorite old salsa guys, but it never sounded right. Those tiny headphones, and even though it's supposed to be higher caliber, you can imagine what becoming so many zeros and ones does to a song. Instead, I just bring my record player to work. Yes, it's a pain, but the quality is incomparable. The iThing sits in my jacket pocket. I keep meaning to accidentally leave it outside the middle school across the street for one of the kids to find. Gordo, Janie says, puffing her way up the last steps to where I stand, chuckling. They call me Gordo because I am gigantic in the old world of rumba and salsa, a legend. Also because I'm fat. I can see by Janie's face she's come to collect up on that favor, so I head her off at the pass. I thought we were straight after I got you that jar full of cemetery dirt, I say, winking. Yeah, she says, turns out that was just you being nice. Really, I say. Turns out I need a bigger favor, and then we'll be straight. Janie works at this swanky Save the Children spot on Lorimer, teaching kids how to be well-behaved, properly speaking little Robotrons. But of course, when the grinning overlords aren't looking, she always slips in some Malcolm X stuff, a little hint about how to get one over on the cops or whatever. Anyway, the kids she was working with, they decided to build a monster. That's what the cemetery dirt was about, apparently. They needed all kinds of ingredients to make it work. It was supposed to be like a team-building exercise or something, you know, from one of those corny books. But then Janie ended up throwing in a little of that Panamanian juju she inherited from her bruja granny, and the damn thing came to life, Frankenstein style. But she says they just caked it together from mud and clay, not a body. Whenever I start a new job, I like to find the perfect spot. You'll see me circling the place like a dog looking for somewhere to sleep. I'll try one, smoke a malagueña, take a nap. let it settle into my body. Then I'll try another. At the cemetery. The perfect spot is on top of this tombstone-speckled hill, a little sheltered outpost that affords me a terrific view of the passing midnight traffic on the BQE, and beyond that, the sparkling city. From here, it's obvious that those skyscrapers are just lit-up graves, different books in the same library. The sky grows dark over the city as Janie tells me her story. The beast was supposed to help their community, something that would look good in a brochure, I suppose, but instead it cut loose, took out into the Williamsburg night. Janie and the kids went after it, and when they finally caught up, what does it do? The thing ate a hipster. Hipster is what they call these newfangled white people that have been moving onto the block. You know, the ones with the tight pants and the big glasses. Now Janie has a serious cleanup job on her hands. You know, I say, the river is really good for that sort of thing. She says it would bother her not to give the kid a proper burial, being that she was partially responsible for his death, and knowing Janie, he'd probably start troubling her dreams. So here I am. At 3 a.m. on a soggy September morning, lugging two ominously heavy trash bags up a remote hill towards a shady grove of trees. I have a shovel and a flashlight, and I'm trying to ignore the way one of the bags is knocking against my back as I walk, like it's trying to get my attention. Still, the thrill of adventure is tickling me like it hasn't done since Nesto's mom made me give up breaking and entering. Perhaps it's tinnitus, but the dead seem to be humming excitedly, a quiet droning accompaniment to my journey. Most people sneak around graveyards to steal bodies. Here I am, bringing one in. And I work here. If I'm caught, at least they will be confused. But then they may think I'm the one that chewed up the boy. I walk a little faster. Untold stores of ferocious grace remain in these old bones, however hidden beneath lard and cholesterol. The hole gets dug pretty fast, but I'm a sweaty disaster when it's done. Just as I heave-ho the two bags in, the crunching of tires on gravel announces the imminent arrival of graveyard security. I probably know the guys. I play dominoes with a few of them at shift change, but still, this would be difficult to explain. I would like to say that I grappled my way down. Even a controlled tumble would have been something. There wasn't time for any of that, though. I plummeted. I felt sure my girth traveling at that speed would have given the planet a jolt, but the splintering bones and squishy body parts I land on break my fall, saving my ass in more ways than one. I try to breathe as quietly as possible as the patrol jeep rumbles close and then wanders away. It's a few hours from dawn, and I'm lying in a fresh grave with two trash bags full of severed hipster parts. So I sit up and light a malagueña. I'm pretty sure I haven't had a stroke or a heart attack. Everything hurts slightly more than usual. Perhaps I'm bleeding internally. That at least would be poetic. I close my eyes and pull a stream of smoke down my trachea to survey the damage. Things seem to be in working order. I exhale and follow the cloud up into the dark sky, above the tombstones, above the trees, above the sparkling city. Souls are rising into the night. It's just graveyard souls at first, but then I start seeing people I know. There's old Corrales and Ruben, my bass player, Silvia de la Cruz, who used to give me head in the back room at Rios. And by the time Nesto Jr. and Janie float by, tears are rolling down my face, which hasn't happened in a few eons. All I hear is the swarming hymn of the dead and the clackety-clacking body parts beneath me. White pus is oozing from the torn-up hipster's limbs and slow-mo flooding through the streets of Brooklyn, a rising tide. The last few scattered souls float up into the sky, and all that's left are kids, 13 and under. It's a whole orchestra of the little guys, each armed with instruments, and they're putting up a fight, coming at the pus with everything they got. I hear them laughing and chattering as they blast homemade fire bombs from trombone cannons and beat back the waves with flame-throwing tubas and sharpened guitar spears. The chattering and laughter of children blends with scattered birdsong as morning breaks around me. Everything is back to normal, but nothing will ever be the same. I sit up, take in the crisp new day air. It's a beautiful morning, but something terrible is coming. Perhaps Janie saw the same vision, and that's why she does what she does. Either way, my own path is clear. I'll drop off this eye thing in front of the middle school. While I'm there, I'll see if they need anyone to teach music or sweep the floors, or both. Maybe At the school, there will be a nice spot for me to smoke and ponder in between classes. I'll see what this new day brings. But first, I have to get out of this hole.
You just heard Graveyard Waltz, read for you by the author, Daniel Jose Holger. And you are now listening to Where Brooklyn Meets Queens by, oh, guess who? Daniel Jose Holger.
Style straightforward, matter factual. I move slow, so my approach seems gradual. My asking name seem all natural. You know, she said, all I know, you know, my name is Lola. Cause your cousin, sister, roll with my crew in Mineola. We were both 15, just digging the scene. Underage at a party, right where Brooklyn meets Queens. Da 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 da. Then let's bust out of here and just walk for a while. I saw the night unfold in the crease of a smile. So we walked out the door and just talked for a while. Then we rolled up Cypher Hill about a quarter of a mile. We talked the future and past and how the good ones don't last. We were walking so slow, but we were moving so fast. It was quarter past three. We was only 15, underage at a party right where Brooklyn meets Queens. Da 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 da. The break of day, the break of day found us well on our way to what's poetically referred to as getting some play. She said, I think it's time to go. I said, come on, baby, stay. She said, all right, I think I might. And then we started.
The website cuts the music off. I am so sorry. Listener, let me finish saying, I'll give you the name of the person at, you know, for at Cross Genres Press. And a wonderful press, I
indeed
should say.
It is.
They really are. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that the website only gave you, like, flavors.
Yeah, I mean, it's most of the song. It's something buggy about the way that we uploaded it. But let me say, that was Aki Burmese singing and playing piano.
He is bleeping amazing.
He is bleeping amazing.
He really is. He was and that drummer. I loved him, too.
Also awesome.
I've never... Now, you see, now this shows how far I go back. He had this, like, little... board that looked like, you know, a clapboard or a washboard.
He had a cajon. That,
say it again?
A cajon. It means big box.
Well.
And that's what he was playing. I know, and it sounded like a whole kit, but he was really, he had
it sounded like a whole kit. It was amazing. I had not heard that before. He was doing the cymbals in realistic fashion, but he had a cajon. How do you spell that?
C-A-J-O-N-E. With an accent.
E. Thank God. Okay. Because with an E and an S, it's something else altogether different.
Indeed. Speaking something of, we can't say.
Speaking of street language. Speaking of street language, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM. At 3 o'clock, by the way, Burn Baby Burn Clappers will be coming your way with Lister, who is already here from way too long a time off during our fundraising drive. So my guest this morning is Daniel Jose Holger. I should mention I am Jim Freund. The program is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction and stuff like that there. And yeah, ghost stories is science fiction. And indeed. Deal with the grammar if you dare on that. I use the Damon Knight definition of science fiction, which is very clear. It's science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Hmm.
It works.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's like, I don't care. If I point at it and call it science fiction, it's science fiction.
Fair enough. Yeah,
you know, if you want to get anything after that is semantics.
Right.
And I love semantics.
Yes.
But not this morning.
No.
So what gets me and what got me, I had my copy of the book at the launch party at Nuyorican. I always say Nuyorican Cafe as runs. Nuyorican Poets Cafe is
correct.
The proper name.
And that was Elijah Tucker playing drums at the that night.
Okay, and who is it on the recording?
On the recording, it's a drummer we used to work with. He moved back to Japan, Daisuke Fujimoto, and an amazing drummer. We've been switching around between drummers. Ghost Star, the main Ghost Star, is me and Aki Pamis, and then we kind of go back and forth with different folks.
And is that a trio usually?
Usually it's a trio, although we've done...
we should mention that's you on guitar, on bass.
That's me on bass. We've done big shows with like cellos and horn sections and backup singers.
Oh, God.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But at our heart of hearts, we're a trio. Sometimes we did a pretty expansive rock opera at the Brooklyn Historical Society based on Crow Hill, which is one of those early independent black communities in Brooklyn. That was really cool. That was 2 years ago. So we do different projects around, but this worked out perfectly. All those songs, I wrote the songs and they were already written, so we kind of all had it ready to go. We just put everything together.
But that was the timing. It was fun. It was really good. And we will give listeners the opportunity at some point to hear that combination. The recording I did at the Nuyorican is not broadcast quality. I have all new equipment and all that. And it was, to do it properly, I would have spoken to the sound people there and we would have had way more of a sound check.
Yeah.
But, you know. There are opportunities that will occur in the future, not to mention the facilities and studios here at WBAI, because that's part of what listener-sponsored radio is about.
Yes.
So, also, I think a studio version, and now you've done studio versions before, obviously, that's what we just heard.
That was actually a live version.
That was live.
Tribeca Performing Arts Center.
Cool.
Yeah.
But
it was through the board.
Through the board, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But studio with fiction, have you recorded any of that?
No.
Yet? Okay.
We need to.
Yeah, you will. Definitely. That's more than a prediction. It's a promise.
All right.
But now the next piece that you want to read will run about approximately how long in minutes?
Yeah.
Just trying to back time.
It's like 20 minutes, so maybe I'll do a piece of it.
Yeah, maybe do a piece of it. Do you want to do a little of that now, or would you like to take phone calls for a couple of minutes?
Why don't we take some calls?
Okay, so if you'd like to speak to Daniel Jose Older about his work, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. We've been getting a couple of calls,
I've noticed.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
But, you know, whether they're relevant or not, well, we'll find out. To hear the phone calls, you will need your headphones, Daniel. Assuming they're working, any pair around there, and volume should be at the base of the cable.
How come it's only coming through one ear?
That's
what it's supposed to do?
No, it's not supposed to. It's because they're broken, like so much around WBAI. Tell me, how about those? Are those?
Yeah, these are better.
Okay, good. Yeah, you got. Yeah, just clip them and switch them.
Sure.
And, next week on this program, I do not yet know what it will be. I'm keeping August a little bit footloose and fancy free because there are some out-of-towners who are coming in and I don't know exactly when, and I want to make sure to make room for them. I have a whole series of interviews from the Nebula Awards. I have a couple of interviews that I conducted at ReaderCon, and there's all this, including a reading at ReaderCon, which included Daniel from various cross-genre writers, which was a lot of fun, but it was largely a sampler, I would say, as opposed to being definitive.
Yeah, well,
in fact, you had to cut a story short.
I had to cut the story short, and I was speeding through the end of it, so don't use that one.
I won't. But there were other things that I recorded there.
There were some great readings there.
There was some, well, yeah, that's the thing about ReaderCon.
Not mine, but there were some other
There were some, well, not that group reading. You didn't have a solo, did you?
No.
Yeah.
I'm just a baby in the world.
Yeah, talk to the programmer there.
Sure.
We know who she is. Anyway, again, telephone number here, 212-209-2900. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Mr. Older.
Good morning, Robert.
Y buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Oh, yeah, we're talking to a Mr. Rodriguez.
Mr. Older.
Bienvenido.
I have so many questions, but I'll start very quickly. Were you actually playing a cajon?
I was not playing a cajon. My drummer was playing a cajon.
I saw that instrument last week, if you can believe this, in an Irish Celtic band.
I believe that.
I was up at a music camp, and there was like, by the way, James, just so you know, in some context, the word cajon, and this fits perfectly, also means coffin.
Ah, excellent. I actually did not
know. In California, the old Hispanic...
It does look like a tiny coffin.
No, but it does mean coffin. In fact, there's a town in California called El Cajon, which actually is called that because it was founded by a coffin maker.
Wow.
You know, Mr. Older, when I'm hearing your story, I am hearing music. Let me tell you what music I was hearing in my head.
Mm.
I was hearing the Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh, perfect.
What a great group.
Yes, they are.
Among many kudos that Ry Cooder has is founding the Buena Vista Social Club in Cuba. All these old guys. The other thing I was hearing was the Afro-Cuban rhythm drum band, all 17 members, as they appeared once at the Croton Festival.
I don't know how one would hear the fiction over them, but okay.
James, I once had to do storytelling on a stage for kids between them and the 200 Voice Men Dingo Griot Singing Society.
Wow.
That was incredible. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Older, because you said something that fascinates me even more. The Jewish-Cuban connection. Now, one of the most fascinating stories is of the hidden Jews of Latin America.
Yes.
The crypto-Jews.
Yes.
Who, in the 1970s,
crypto-Jews.
Surfaced in the American Southwest, and there's a whole controversy I'd love to talk to you. Was your family one of the families that fled Spain in 1492 and showed up in the Caribbean?
Not at all, but I'm familiar with that history, and it is beautiful. And
The Spanish Inquisition did cause a few people to leave.
And yes. Many of them. There's an old joke that when Columbus fled, he had a rabbi, a CPA, a lawyer, and a banker with him. But a lot of Jews showed up in Mexico, hidden Jews as conquistadors. One of the most famous ones was Cabeza de Vaca, who got lost in Arkansas looking for Florida.
That's
wandered
happened
around for 11 years, but there were a number of them who showed up. And what fascinates me is that at a festival in Winnipeg many years ago, there was a Cuban family who fled, whose ancestors fled. They were Galician bagpipe players, and they were Jewish.
Wow.
400 years, hidden Jews in Cuba.
There it is. There's some beautiful synagogues in Havana, actually.
Oh, you've seen them?
Yeah.
Have you done any research on Cuban folklore? Because that fascinates me as much.
You could say that, yeah.
The African connection, Santeria.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you really want Cuban folklore, when we have Carlos Hernandez back, he writes, sort of a standard, like it's really standard, a Latino magical realism with the awareness of Cubano, born in Queens.
Was he the one, Jim, that read the story on your program Saturday morning about the Santeria grandmother?
Yes.
Ah, that was wonderful.
Yeah, from Interfiction, from the first Interfiction.
Santeria cookbook.
Yeah. Well, you have good memory. That was 4 years ago.
Well, you know, it's one last thing of Mr. Older.
Yeah.
The reason that I was fascinated by the Cuban-Jewish connection, my parents...
And then we have to move on.
Santo Domingo. Mm-hmm.
Ah.
The first people they ever saw when they were young were judíos y turcos. Now, down there, turcos is anything for Arab.
Right.
Arabe turcos.
Right.
But the first things that my parents remember was Jewish cooking at the age of 12.
Wow.
Good luck and keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. we can take calls in a while, but I think we ought to get to the next story.
Let's do a section of it.
Yeah, okay. And, well, there's, here's a song that's only a minute 22. That won't throw us off, will it?
No.
And you think that
I don't know what song you're talking about.
I don't want to say it because I'll ruin it. En Exilio? Exio?
That's a very sort of slow, sad song.
But I don't know what you're reading. What are you reading?
Just the beginning of Tenderfoot.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah. Not... Not really. Tenderfoot wants something a little.
There's a song on there called Salsa Nocturna.
Yes.
Play that.
Okay, very good.
You're going to play it at the end?
At the end.
Okay.
Unless you need a break now.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Although that starts a little slow. You could still, yeah, that'll be fine.
Well, okay. what? I was going to say, are you going to end at one of these sections here?
Yeah, I didn't know.
After
which
what,
one
the
yet.
Second? You don't know yet which. Okay. Yeah, because if I know, I could start back timing.
Yes.
Anyway. That's for a different production.
Indeed.
But, I was going to remark.
Yes.
That at your reading live, and I, you know, digressed as always. And here I notice you do not necessarily, the text that you read is not the text that Cross Genres has published.
I don't know what you're talking about. there are
entire phrases that.
Entire
phrases.
There's always an element of improvisation to a reading.
Okay.
I would say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. I wouldn't say entire phrases. Although maybe
I can demonstrate to you off the air.
If you say so.
But in contrast to like once having one of the times Chip Delaney, Samuel R. Delaney was on the program and he's reading a story from and he stops in the middle of reading. He says, "Well, that's a mistake. They got it wrong." And this is like, you know, 20 years after the story's been published or something like that.
That's happened many times.
Yeah.
To all of us.
No doubt. But, you know, Chip's got. And he'll also say, I've also seen him blue pencil in the middle of reading a story that he published years ago. And said, I can improve that.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens. Well, I think when you read it out loud, there is a different magic to prose when it's spoken out loud. There's a power to it that. You know, I mean, it's sort of a trite piece of advice for writers to read out loud before you submit anywhere.
It's not trite.
I mean, it's trite only that it's said a lot. I don't think it's listened to enough.
It's not said enough.
It's
sometimes.
Maybe not said enough. We were talking about it on Twitter today. There was an author talking about it. It really matters.
It's essential.
I think it speaks to how much writing is really storytelling at its root. And I think we forget that as writers often.
Yeah, I mean, the fellow we just spoke to is from the tradition of storytelling more than reading.
Right.
And it really is.
But so connected.
And this is why I always point out that radio is sometimes an even better medium than the written word because it is storytelling.
Right.
You know, to get into which is better, neither is better, but both are good and both are superior to the imaged word.
Yeah. I think it's not about better or worse. I think it's that we can be very distracted by the words on the page and forget that we're speaking the words. And that even when you're reading it, you know, there's still a voice in your head that's reciting it. So it's always, there's some element of, you know, that's why rhythm matters, all these things, they matter. And you can't quite get them if you don't say it out loud.
Absolutely. But I also like to point out that we do better special effects here on the radio than they do in the movies.
Well, then there's that.
That's all.
So. Tenderfoot. You ready? I remember Delton Jennings. Bumped into him pretty regularly on my late night sojourns, and the guy was nice enough if you could get past the rambling and the hygiene issues. But this flattened mass of flesh, blood-crusted hair, and organs, they put a name tag where they guessed the foot would have been and called it a day. The one thing that is impossible not to notice is the smell. It's not the pee plus beer plus a quarter century of body odor combo that Delton usually rocked. It's something more animal-like, as if he'd been wrestling in a zoo and lost. I concentrate hard, watching the air around him for those little shining satellites that tell me what's going on with folks, but nothing comes. He's already been dead at least 6 hours, rotting in this morgue for 3, so whatever memories his corpse carried could easily have fluttered away. But then, slowly, a few flashes return. It's the sound of leaves rustling, something huge moving through the underbrush. A flash of terror courses through me. I assume it was Delton's, because I don't frighten easily. I hear a high-pitched shrieking, something not human. A few flashes of light burst out of the darkness, and the inside of my head turns somersaults. Then everything goes black. I'm dizzy when I open my eyes. It's not that I'd been expecting Little Bo Peep, but dealing with this giant screeching monstrosity seems a little out of my pay grade. My creepy, translucent bosses at the Council of the Dead are going to need to hear about this. But there's a few more leads to check up on first. I like to get a strong Puerto Rican coffee after I visit the morgue. It's the perfect palate cleanser for all that creepy sterility. I sip the extra strong, extra sweet brew out of a little paper cup as I walk up Nostrand Ave towards Eastern Parkway. I'm sure the ghostly dickheads upstairs have selected my half-dead, half-alive ass to do this job for some nefarious reason. I'm the only one like me, far as anyone knows, and it gets lonely. But the council always finds a way to use my situation to their advantage. The rain keeps starting and stopping like an anxious lover who doesn't know if he should spend the night. The sky has been clouded over all day, but the true evening darkness is just beginning to settle in. I finish my coffee and walk into the sloping park that's nestled between the botanical gardens and the library. Like drunk teenagers with too much toilet paper, cops have strewn that ridiculous yellow tape haphazardly across the upper park area. I find that if I act like a real dick and scowl a lot, I don't even have to flash the fake badge that the Council of the Dead gave me. The street grunts just assume I'm some high-up brass they've never met and do whatever I tell them. But I'm not in a mood to take chances, so I exaggerate my grimace, lean hard on my wooden cane, and flip out the silver shield. With a few arbitrary curses thrown in for good measure, the two uniforms guarding the crime scene fall right into line. You can tell the new guys, because they have a lot to prove. It's written all over their faces. This one's named O'Malley, and he's masking how mortified he is with an exaggerated brotherhood of cops chumminess. "What's going on, sir?" he chuckles like we're old college buddies. "Didn't know the brass wanted in on this one." "We don't," I say curtly. I don't like forced friendliness, especially when I'm in character. "Just swinging through for a look-see. Where's the kill spot?" O'Malley makes a "I'll take him, you stay here" sign to his partner, who just rolls his eyes. I follow the kid up a winding path into the darkening underbrush. "You should have seen the body, man," he yammers. "It was like someone ironed him." I'm too busy trying to weed out all the new guy excitement this guy's projecting, so I can focus on the crime scene. So far, though, it's just your basic city park deal. The slow pulsing of plant life arching towards the sky, a flurry of insects, and the scattered frenzy of mid-sized mammals scurrying for trash. Oh, yes, and the unforgettable aura of homelessness, that pungent lived-in clothes desolation. "Here we go, boss." O'Malley waves his light over a dark stain on the path. "This is where the bum got done." I scowl at him and walk up close to where Delton's blood is slowly absorbing into the cement. Forensics teams and the urban wilderness have swallowed up most of the useful details. A few candy wrappers and beer bottles lay scattered around, remnants of Delton's last supper, no doubt. And a little further away, there's a used condom and an old hat. None of this is particularly helpful. I take a step into the total darkness of the underbrush. It's here I realize that there's something else odd about the park tonight. It'd been bothering me since I stepped in, but I couldn't put my finger on it, like a humming you don't notice until it stops. There's no ghosts here. Usually, any city park hosts a whole cross-section of spirits. This park's particularly alive with the dead. You can see them fluttering in their strange circles like glow bugs any time after sunset. Well, I can anyway. But tonight, it's like an empty schoolhouse, a silence so deep it curls up inside my ears. Then, all at once, I'm inundated by a rush of thick, pungent wind. The trees around me tremble and send up mournful shushings. Back on the path, O'Malley shifts his weight uneasily from one foot to the other. The leaves convulse more frantically. I hear the snapping of branches. Something huge is moving very quickly towards us. I smell it before I see it. That same old feces circus tent stench from the body. O'Malley yells, and I duck as three gunshots ring out behind me. There's a flurry of motion. The huge, fast thing lets out its deafening shriek and thunders towards us. It's only a fuzzy flicker, tall as a two-story building, long matted hair and all shiny transparent like a jellyfish. It bursts out of the trees and knocks me on my ass. For the first year after my death, I got the heebie-jeebies each time I rolled up on some runaway spook. In time, I got used to it, and I haven't felt much of anything for quite a while. This situation, on the other hand, has reached some place deep inside of me and crushed all that cool-headed resolve. "Find out what's going on," the council message had said. "Okay, I found out. There's a huge hairy freak show in the park. Done." I hear the inhuman shriek mixed with the wet crunching sound that's probably the end of Officer O'Malley. I don't look back. Don't think. I just run. I don't stop running until I reach my friend Victor's spot in Crow Hill. I ring the bell until I collapse in a heap on his doorstep, and only then do I realize I'm bleeding.
Section of Tenderfoot by Daniel Jose Older from his collection Salsa Nocturna, which is also the name of this composition, here over WBAI, New York. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Daniel Jose Older. And you were going to outro that cut, Salsa Nocturna, we were talking off the air.
Yes. That's a piece that I actually originally made for a choreographer named Tina Vasquez, who created a whole dance piece to it. But it works perfectly also with the stories.
It really does, yeah.
I used it in the promo video, which is on the website. But the singer that you hear there is an old Cuban man that I met in Havana. That he actually was the watchman over some kind of ministry of agriculture. They have all these different ministries. Basically, he would sit on the overnight shift in a garden, in an atrium, in a building. And, you know, we would sit there and drink coffee and talk about stuff. He was probably in his 70s or something. And he would just start singing boleros, you know, late into the night. So I just started recording him.
Wow.
Yeah, so I just held on to those recordings.
And okay, that is...
It's good stuff, and I remixed it. Some of those sounds there are like found sounds, scissors, things just bumping around that I just used in my apartment.
Oh, my God.
And then there's a wawanko. The gentleman caller earlier talked about some of the traditional Afro-Cuban things that you know, the folklore. And that's actually... I'm involved with the Lukumi community in New York. It's a very beautiful tradition that's still very alive in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, in Harlem, an ever-changing culture, and it influences my work a lot. It's very deep, actually, the spirituality aspect, and I think if you read it with that in mind, it's a whole other read, in a way.
And how much, to what extent, does Cuban culture influence your writing? I mean, the urbanity, to me, it's very New York, and obvious from what you're saying, of course, it's informed by Boston, but I don't see that. I just see
right
that, and I'm wondering, you know, with the ghostly parts and all that, which I actually see in some ways as very, but, you know, we all put into it what we want, and so part of what I want, especially in some of the stories that are funnier. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the word elephant, ghost elephant. That should conjure up some hilarity for people. I was laughing. That's the second story in the
That's Tenderfoot. That's the first one.
Oh, it is Tenderfoot.
That's the one.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean that story is a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of writers like Thorne Smith, I was saying earlier. For those who don't know who Thorne Smith is, think of Topper, I Married a Witch. Think of all the ghost stories of the 1930s, usually about the 1%. And, you know, very wealthy people and all that who are forced to confront reality by a ghost. Sometimes they're in the 1%, like in the original Topper, but later on, mm-hmm. not so much, like Joan Blondell or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And Thorne Smith is one of the most wonderful writers of supernatural stories set in urban things. But these are like stories from The New Yorker.
Right.
And things like that. So I'm wondering, and then there's Theodore Sturgeon. Mm-hmm. Who's one of my favorite stories of Sturgeon, which starts out as a very light story. It's called Shottle Bop. That's bottle shop with some inverted letters there. And it's just a person who isn't a great person, or I think can be a little bit selfish, but discovers that he can see the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to him to do favors for the spirit world, and he finds this very fulfilling.
Hmm.
And I won't go through the entire story. It's a long story. It's a novelette. But the end of it is not so funny. It all of a sudden turns into a brilliant, scary ghost story at the end.
Hmm.
But it starts comedy.
Right.
And that's why that's another person. And then Jim Butcher,
mm-hmm.
What's the name of the series? They actually made a TV series out of
The Dresden Files.
The Dresden Files, Harry Dresden.
Right.
You know who that's urban fiction enough, although exceedingly Chicago.
Right.
Guy walking around with a hockey stick, a wizard walking around with a hockey stick,
yeah,
and dealing with the spirit world. And I find your stuff nestles very, very nicely in there, as opposed to what people tend to think of as, say, standard Hispanic magical realism. Standard, the word doesn't apply to the great Spanish writers who come from South America and Central America. Borges, you know, simply leading a pack. Who would you style?
I love Borges. It's interesting. I was about to mention him. I love Gabriel García Márquez.
Márquez is amazing.
I would say that I draw from both. I mean, I love some of the old noir stuff, too. I really try to take
influence. Yeah, you've been calling your stuff noir, and it clearly is.
Yeah, I try to draw from a lot of different places.
I would call Butcher dark more than noir, even though he's writing a PI.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of noir elements. I only read one of his books, but there's sort of a goofiness that he draws to it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's that, and I think that I really would say that I take a lot of influence from the storytelling that we do in our everyday lives. So, you know, whether it's on the job, you can imagine that paramedics have our stories.
And yeah, we haven't talked at all about the fact that you're a paramedic and how that must inform your work.
I would say that there's you know, people always say, oh, you must have a lot of great stories from what you do. And that's true. Believe me, when I've been doing it for almost 10 years, and there are a lot of great stories. But the other
And people, by the way, you have a whole blog just about being a paramedic,
yes,
which is probably a primary focus for many, many people.
It's And it's definitely one of the ways that I would say I sort of honed my fiction skills was blogging, because it really just focuses you on the story, and it doesn't allow you to, you know, when I do one of the ambulance blogs, I just spit it out in like 20 minutes maximum. I'm just like, because it's just the question, what happened? Okay, this is what happened, and you put it down on paper, and if you think of fiction that way,
wow,
it simplifies a lot. And, you know, just tell the story, just tell the effing story is like really what it comes down to, and it can be decomplexify the process, which we sometimes get up in our heads about.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say is the other side of it is, it's, yes, the stories that we see and more than see actually deal with, which is really what I like about the job, is you're not just bearing witness, you're actually being very involved with people's lives on a deep level. But it's also the storytelling from, you know, in between medics, which is magnificent. I mean, the people's different ways of explaining the different messes that we have been in and gotten out of and all the different situations is a language unto itself. And there's just a lot of, you know, and that's just the one side. And there's old men on the corner and there's kids at school. And there's a whole literature of storytelling that happens, you know, in the street every day. And I do draw on that because I think that's, like I said before, that's really the root of literature still. So, you know, I try to keep the balance.
Yeah. And but the voice that comes out of it is wonderful. The sound that comes out, you know, because as a radio person,
right,
I'm into the sound. I entered your world through the prose.
Right.
And through the fiction. Mm-hmm. But I became, and I went from enjoying it to going, wow,
mm-hmm,
because of the sound of it.
Mm.
Which for me, well, given, you know, where I'm sitting and what we're doing,
right,
is really what I guess my life has been about, is the author's voice, the author's sound.
Right, because that's what matters. I think when you find your voice as an author, that something does click for you.
Yeah.
And it's always a struggle to write in different ways. But I think when you sort of click in with a voice that makes sense, the struggle changes and it becomes something that you're more attuned to instead of wrestling against.
Yeah.
And then you kind of can flow with it.
But adding the music and the you know, with the sound of the language and all that, and the sound of the street and everything that is in there, it makes for me this extremely powerful combination of things. So if people want to call, by the way, 212-209-2900, we will say good morning. You are on the radio. Yellow.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
All right, and good morning, Mr. Oder.
Good morning, sir.
From Bulgaria.
This is a phone call coming from Bulgaria.
Is that right? Whoa. Well, welcome.
Well, I enjoyed the readings tonight, the brief short story and the segment of the other one, and I was wondering if there is a soundtrack to the book in some way, like if there is a CD bound in the book with the wonderful music you were playing or something like that, or...
That's a great question.
Maybe in some future books.
I think future is it's definitely something that's been in the works. Jim and I have spoken about it, putting something together. If you go
And I speak a great deal with the publishers at Cross Genres Press. We did a reading of their Subversive collection, as a matter of fact, last January. And it's something I think that can be discussed.
But if you go on the website, GhostStar.net, there's a player that has both music from my band, GhostStar, and music that I've produced on my own for different choreographers.
That's GhostStar.net.
So one has the opportunity to collect their own soundtrack to it.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a couple of songs you can buy, and there's some. The rest of them you can just live stream all the time. And I would say they do complement. It wasn't done intentionally, but I think I've been sort of wrestling with the same themes in music and in literature.
There's no reason for you to make anything such as excuses it not being done intentionally.
No, not an excuse. I think it's kind of amazing that they've
enjoyed it in a way. Listening to the stories, I was wondering if you would talk more about who you were influenced by later with Shang Up and all that. Who you were influenced by, because I hear some pointers to things I've read.
Right.
But I'm guessing there's things I haven't read that have also influenced it, which would be interesting for listeners to know.
Sure. That's a great question, yeah. Well,
I don't think, Jim, you have mentioned the phone number for people who want to call tonight.
I did, and we have a few calls, so it's 212-209-2900.
Well, I know that. anyhow, and you were talking about how things should be read out loud.
Mm-hmm.
A very easy way, I think, to make this, to show this to people who are not inclined to believe you, is to give them some of Edgar Allan Poe's stories to read out loud.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
And also like Moby Dick, for instance, or something like that.
But even, you know, if you're writing a complicated email, before you send that off, and that's a meaningful email, read it out loud to yourself before actually sending it. It makes a difference.
I'll keep that in mind for the future, Jim.
Indeed. Well, I'll tell you this about influences. The two writers that I would credit with getting me back into the writer's chair are Junot Diaz and Walter Mosley. When it comes to voice, Junot Diaz is like beyond. There's just
beyond compare.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing, and he tells a great story. Walter Mosley too, with the voice, with the story, the characterization.
That's where some of your noir is coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think also just for both of them, these are writers who really engage with the world around them on a deep level, both in their, you know, in their fiction and in the world, in the way that they carry themselves and the editorial stuff that they've written, the nonfiction, but particularly just the fiction, you can't read.
And Mosley's done the impossible, switching over from mystery to science, and to include science fiction.
Yeah, although I haven't read a lot of his science fiction. Easy Rollins.
He started, I would say, shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And picked it up real fast. He's good.
He's a great writer. I mean, anything you
he's written great science fiction.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is not what people think of when they think of Walter Mosley.
I read the one piece that he had in Dark Matter, which I loved.
Yeah, but that was sort of his start. Cherie Renee Thomas sort of started him off. Now read his fourth science fiction novel, which came out earlier this year.
Cherie Renee Thomas, who wrote the introduction to this book.
That's right.
Who is... just an amazing person, too.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you for a great
Thank you show. For calling, all the way from Bulgaria.
Have a great morning, and...
You too.
Look forward to finish reading the story you started reading.
Great.
Okay, thanks so much, Bobson. Take care.
All right.
Great day.
Okay, bye-bye. Oh, we had another call, but it went away. And we have, 4 minutes, 4 minutes left before we have to start outroing. So we can squeeze one more call in.
All right.
212-209-2900. But let's use this opportunity now to remind people, A, the name of the book is Salsa Nocturna.
Yes.
It's available at...
it's available on Amazon.
It's available, yeah, at on Amazon, I think. But it should be also at Barnes & Noble.
It's on Barnes & Noble. Yeah, there's an e-version. You can get it on your Nook. You can get it on your Kindle. Or you can get a paperback version.
Too. Yeah, I propose get the EPUB because you can read that on anything.
Yes.
And Cross Genres Press. I think you can get it directly through them from the publisher.
Correct.
Is another way of doing it.
Terrific independent publisher in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Somerville, yeah.
Yeah. And the name of the author and composer of the music we've been hearing again, Daniel Jose Older.
That's me.
Can all check that out. And even though we had two calls, and when I said, you know, we have time for one more call, they both like dropped off the bottom. Yeah. And, well, we have to get off at 2:56:30.
I see.
So, in order to get the outro music in and to get Lister on the air on time with Burn Baby Burn Clapper. But, Daniel, you and I, we got, you know, people, I've been pretty blatant about it on the air, but, you know, you permitting, I got plans.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that which is, by the way, when we are on the air pitching for listener-sponsored radio,
mm-hmm.
let me point out that the ability to find resources like Daniel and use them, like a 50,000-watt radio station, not to mention the power of the internet that goes behind it so that we can take phone calls from Bulgaria.
Right.
The marriage of all of this coming into, you know, to provide an art form that you're not hearing on other radio stations, that, folks, he said, pontificating, is the power of listener-sponsored radio. You just don't get that elsewhere.
True story.
Yeah, so the next time we ask you for money, since we just funded a thon, means we won't have one for at least a week. Remember that when you pledge. And you can always also, by the way, pledge any time at our website, wbai.org. So, what have you got planned for the, any performances coming up in the immediate future you can announce? People want to see you live?
There's going to be more. There's none that I can announce. But the New Yorker wants us to come back. So that will happen.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You filled the house.
We did fill the house. It was a really successful event on a number of levels. Very exciting.
Yeah, when it was over, they were counting their take. The bar was happy.
We were all happy. It was a happy night.
It really was.
There's a bookstore up in Harlem, Spanish Harlem, called Casa Azul. It's a new bookstore. And we haven't confirmed anything, but I hope to do an event there. It's a really great place.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be more shows. We're talking about doing one in Boston, which is where Cross Genre is.
Right.
And
we have to do another in Yersif.
But
one themed with you question is, again, who match you. Because last time you read was part of Anthology.
Subversion, right. Right.
And so...
But I will say that I've begun Salsa Nocturna 2.
Excellent.
I don't know if that'll be the title yet, but I certainly started writing a lot more short stories in the same world there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a full-length novel about Carlos, who's the character in the story that I just read, that is sort of making the rounds right now. But it's basically about his origins, as why he's half-dead, and why it's called the Half-Resurrection Blues.
Okay.
So it's him kind of discovering
his own roots. Yeah, I did notice that we sort of walk into his...
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah, the novel, the full-length novel takes place earlier than these stories, where he's sort of coming to grips with the fact that he died mysteriously, was resurrected partially and mysteriously, and has no idea what his life was about.
So in a future show, we'll talk about the chronology
of
some of this. But I like Carlos. I like Carlos.
Carlos is a likable dude. Yeah. He's complicated, but yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Our time is up. It's all too short.
Indeed. Of course it is.
And
that's the way it is.
But this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Tune in again next week at 1:30, or use archive.wbai.org as a portal. Actually, just come to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and that's a portal to all things Our Wolfie. And also the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We're also on Facebook with the Yersif group and with an Hour of the Wolf group. And until next week, I thank you for listening, regardless of until next week. And Daniel, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Ours. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers, coming your way with Lister over these airwaves imminently. Good morning and take care. We go out, as always, with Steel Eye Span.
Last words on my lips, I am. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
fish.
The red, white, and the blue who spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? Love you the most.